On the phone, you said you were concerned you might have multiple personality disorder.
Yep, that too. Got buttloads of peeps living in my brain. No doubt. We should talk about it.
Coaches, welcome back to another episode of Talking Split. I am Rob Calder, joined by Dave Peters, the man that is currently running all of Vic Metro now. Welcome, DP.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
And the man sporting a New York Knicks drink bottle, Nick Mihai.
I make sure it comes up in every pod so far.
Yes, it's interesting. Now, the hard part is this podcast won't come out until next Friday. So we've already got one loaded for this Friday. So we are in a world where either the Knicks have won it or they've lost it. Nick, do you want to just give us your thoughts on what New York City might look like, depending on how this plays out?
Well, the best way to describe it is we were talking about it before, right? Whether we win the series or lose the series, New York City will turn into Gotham and only Batman will save them.
It's going to be carnage.
It's going to be anarchy, 100%.
Yeah,
think about 27 years since we've been in the finals and what is it, 50 years since we've won it or something. Like, you know, a lot of our supporters supported the Knicks when Pablo Prigioni was our starting point guard and Steve Novak was our starting four. And like, they're good players, don't get me wrong, but
they're two names that have never appeared on this podcast before, I can tell you that.
I'm dropping them. No, yeah, I was ready. Yeah.
Jeremy Lin.
I was going to say Lin Sanity.
Yeah, Lin Sanity was good, yeah. Yeah, very exciting. Very exciting and nervous as well.
Yeah,
You notice the apparel and the bottles are starting to come out though, like the socks and the bottle. The Knicks bottle, and it's
the closet Knicks fans are slowly emerging. But it will be interesting to see what this looks like over the next week and a half or so. By the time you hear this, we'll have a result, I think, by that stage. So
we'll have a result. It'll be done. Yeah. We'll get it done.
Yeah, there's no way known.
Please.
Yeah, there's no way known they're allowed to win or lose that in New York. I'm certain of that. It'll have to be done 100%. In San Antonio. But anyway, we're into the podcast for this week. So what we have done this week is, and this got born by a conversation I was having with a coach the other day that was starting to talk about players they had in their team and how they struggled to coach them. And they're like, I've got this type of player that does this. And I'm like, oh, I've had that type of player before. And they thought, I've got this type of player that does this. And I reckon I've had that type of player before. And it's like, this is like, are there some commonalities in personalities in players that we just see that just appear? You don't get all of them, obviously, in the same year. You get various stages. You'll get one that crops up over the course. But it was more a case of they were wondering, how do I coach this type of a player? And it sort of got me thinking a little bit. It's like, well, okay, what type of personalities can we come up with in this sort of world and what does it potentially look like? So we've got 12. Whether we get through all 12 or not remains to be seen, because I am conscious of time that we also have another meeting to get to after this one. So we'll see how it shakes out. But the first one we're going with is the overachiever. So the one that is super hard on themselves all the time. They're really driven. They're detail-oriented. They want to be good. Like, you can see they genuinely want to be good all the time, but they're a little bit fragile, I suppose, mentally. Like, they have those cracks in them that something goes wrong and it's not just a small problem, it's a catastrophe type problem. You can't really give them positive feedback because it doesn't quite hit with them, like those types of players. So the overachiever is what we're talking about. So Dave, we'll start with you on this one. Like, how do you normalize coaching that type of a player? Like, and how much time does it take, I suppose?
Yeah, look, those players are great to have because, you know, they care a lot straight away. They have a passion for the game. They have a passion, hopefully, for winning, and they want to do the right thing by you and the team. But the fact that they are so hard on themselves makes it difficult for you because you feel like, as a coach, it's your job to provide that constructive criticism, that feedback, and they're almost already doing it for you and quite usually they're very negative to themselves. So it's a bit of a balancing act. It's trying to find out what they're judging their game on, what I think they should be judging their game on, and then finding out whether they're focusing on the right things and then working out where I can provide positive feedback to kind of balance out some of the negative they're already providing themselves. Yeah. If I know they're so hard on themselves constantly, it's something that I need to be aware of, potentially in a timeout, not letting them know, hey, bad shot, we didn't need to see this, because I already know in their head they've gone through that in the last 30 seconds. They've replayed that shot. They already know, hey, I took a bad shot.
It's It is taxing though. Yep. Like these types of I probably struggle with these players the most because I don't know how to approach them. And it is, it's that counterbalance type, do I need to be super positive with them because they're hard on themselves? But then it's like, but if it's not hitting anyway, is it just white noise to them? Like, and I don't know. It's a bit of a challenge, this one, because players generally don't lack confidence. And I'm saying very generally in this sort of space. Usually they probably think they're a little bit better than where they are in that sort of reality. But these types of players I really struggle with. And it's, you've almost got to normalize mistakes with them, I feel like. It's a challenge. Like, do you have much experience with these types of players, Nick?
I do. I actually have experience with it recently as well. So, like, I find a lot of the time these types of players are over-analyzers. So at my level where you can have access to film, they're watching way too much film. There's no real goalposts about what they're looking for. So for some of these players, I sat down with them and gave them some goalposts. Okay, you can watch the film still, because I think for these sorts of players, if you just take everything away, it's too much too quickly. So what we came up with was, all right, so on Monday you'll get the film. You can watch it all the way through and then you can watch it again and you can pause it and figure out what things you want to work on, and that's it. Monday's done. So that's your parameter. So you get a little bit of that still. Tuesday, if you're lifting and you do gym and you're doing your team trainings, that's what you do. So I mapped it out basically on an Excel spreadsheet and made sure he had a, all right, Friday is your rest day. You don't look at film. You don't look at scout. You want to get shots up for 20 minutes. You can do that. That's fine. And then start preparing for Saturday. And that's really helped those players. Like, it's just something I learned probably just this year, that when they start to, you know, overanalyze and really look at it, if you map it out for them a little bit instead of just saying, hey, you know, relax, it's all good. Because I just find that they, when they overanalyze, it's almost like they're trying to get to perfection, and basketball doesn't work that way. So one of the conversations I had with them as well is, hey, I'm just letting you know, you're going to miss shots, you're going to turn over the ball, and you're going to foul someone when you shouldn't have fouled someone. I'm just going to get that in your head right now. That is going to happen at some point, and you got to learn to find ways to deal with that.
And part of it is getting them more on the process rather than the outcome, I think, is that they are so, that was a bad shot. So, okay, what led up to that in the first place? Like, had you not seen the ball in the last three possessions, so you felt like you had to fire away on this one? Was that the right read? Those sorts of things. So rather than making it direct of you shot the ball when you shouldn't have shot the ball, you can ask that question, you know, and you get a little bit more of what they're actually thinking. It's like, was that the best shot we could have found? And usually they're a little bit bitey on that, and it's like, no. It's like, okay, let's just check that tone for a second. But you know, what can it potentially look like from here? Well, okay, what could have been done to get a better shot? Like, was there someone else open? Those sorts of things. And I think it is more process. Like, get them tied back into, okay, it's not, you're bang on, it's not going to be perfect every time. So how can we at least get you onto the right path so that the decision might be perfect every time? You know, the outcome is a variable, of course, but the decision might be perfect in that sort of space. And find ways to almost bring them back, because you've seen these kids, when I say kids, this is adults as well, get in their own heads a little bit, where it's just like, it's only negative talk, and it's only negative, and it's only negative, and that starts to get a little, not toxic is not quite the right word, but they start to become unenjoyable, one, to coach, but two, to play with. And that creates a different problem. Mm. I think now you've got to try and manage the personalities on top of the personalities. That's hard work.
Sometimes I ask them a question and it ends up with a little bit of silence as well, where I go, hey, do you like playing basketball? I'm just curious. And it's almost like, well, yeah, of course. You know what I mean? Yeah, of course I do. But like, I'm trying to judge their body language of like, do you? Because like, this sounds like a job, what you're talking about, analyzing and being negative on the court and things like that. That sounds exhausting. You're not even getting paid for this. You know, you're voluntarily doing a job.
And I feel like, just going back to what you said, Rob, sometimes they're so stuck in their head that they're focusing on one player, one possession that barely affected the scoreboard. And then you look up at the scoreboard and your team's up 10. So big picture, just allowing them to see that, reminding them, hey, yep, not our best possession, but we're up 10, process is working, yep, let's just keep moving, you know.
Yep. And I do wonder, I suppose, at times where this comes from. Like, are some kids just wired this way? In which case, yeah, I get it. Is there some external pressure?
That's what I was going to say.
Potentially, yep, coming from the car ride, maybe. you know, you don't really know. Like, is their game going to be unpacked on the drive to and from? You know, that can be a bit of a challenge as well. So it's not a case of they're not trying. Like, and that's one of the positives. Like, it's never a case of they're not trying. They're always trying. Like, that's the least of your concerns. It's just they've almost become so enamored with the result, they haven't thought about what makes up getting to that result, I think. So it's an interesting personality type, and it is genuinely one of the ones I struggle with the most. I really do struggle with that, because there are times you just want to sit there and you just snap out of it. Like, I don't need it. Like, grow up, figure it out. Like, that's what's going on in my head as well. But it's like, well, you can't say that, like, because that's just going to make the problem worse. But, you know, you do tend to struggle, I feel like, on that one. So the next personality type, we'll go to you first, Nick, on this one, is the natural. Mm-hmm. So the kid that just kind of picks it up and is good at it straight away but doesn't really have to work for it. So you think about those kids that could just almost pick up any sport they wanted and just be good at it straight away. Like, that surface level ability, like, it's like, and I'll say the name just because we've all coached him at various stages. Like, Tom Wilson struck me as one of those kids. Like, if he decided he wanted to be good at water polo, I feel like he'd just be good at water polo. Like, he was just one of those kids that was good at everything. Now, he went on to be a high achiever, obviously, in two separate sports, but he just struck me as a bit of a natural. Mm. Like, how do you go coaching those types of kids?
Mm. Christian Petrarca was probably another one as well, right? Yep. Like, he was just naturally good athlete and just translated to so many different sports.
Yep.
When they pick things up and they have that natural ability, I tried to lean in and develop their leadership skills, like some other layer of their game that's outside of it. So they're already picking this stuff up fast. Let's get them helping other guards. Let's get them, hey, talk to the big about twisting the screen so you can come back on that different angle and why you want that to happen, because they already probably have a bit of knowledge, right? They pick up the game quite quickly. So I would be talking to them about taking more of that leadership role at an older age group. Those sorts of natural players that pick things up and they've built those leadership skills, I would have them in the conversation with the coaches on who's going to play this weekend, which 12, so they have a voice as well. So I would add layers where it's not so comfortable for them, if that makes sense.
Yep, challenging, because there are times, like, how do you deal with, like, I'm interested in your take on this, DP. How do you deal with that type of a kid that almost makes it look like so easy that you question if they're trying in the first place?
Yeah, difficult, because I think I had a couple of them back in the day, and sometimes we judge effort based on how hard we think they're sprinting or how hard they're sliding defensively or something like that. And some people don't need to work to their maximal capacity to have success, is what we found back in the day. So it's hard to have those conversations and provide them direct feedback because they're still having success on the court.
Yep.
And what I found with how we talk to those players is similar to Nick, is it's a little bit different. I'm talking from a junior perspective. We're not so much just talking at them and providing this is what we need to do, A, B, and C. A lot more of it is conversations around what do you think of this? This is what I'm seeing. What are you seeing? And making sure that they understand that their knowledge and their IQ is, we can see that. We've observed that they're probably a little bit ahead of the rest of the group. And we think that they can help us and help the team in a slightly different way than maybe some of the other players on the team can. So it's, for lack of a better phrase, it's bringing them into the tent, having their words mean a little bit more behind the scenes so that they know they're sort of a part of the architect of what we're trying to do offensively and defensively.
Yeah, I really like both what you've said there is using them for good, so to speak, because the challenge is that they get bored.
Yeah,
and all of a sudden it's like, we're doing this again. Like, I'm already good at this. It's like, yeah, you are. Like, we're not disputing that part, but how engaged are they? That's the challenge at times, because it wouldn't be anything for them to turn up at training. Let's go, look, I don't really need to get at first gear here, and I can probably win most of the drills, most of the scrimmages will be. Like, so how engaged are they? And the risk is they get bored, and that's what worries me the most.
And on the flip side of that as well, like, you have to keep them equally accountable to the values you have. Like, if there's a non-negotiable, Like, don't give them an out because, oh, you know, they're the natural player. I need them on Friday. No, they want to be coached just as much as the other players that are developing and are not so natural at it as well. I think sometimes coaches do fall into that trap about, oh, you know, I don't need to be as hard because they're naturally picking this up. No, they still need to be held accountable on closing out and guarding the ball and when they need to help and when they don't need to help, that stuff. If that's your non-negotiables, they must be held to the same standard.
And it is challenging because I agree, like completely agree. Like you still need to coach that player. And I've had a bit of a knack in the past of just stacking the deck against them. And it's like, yeah, okay, you are a natural player and you're talented and all those sorts of things. We're going to start this scrimmage with your team down by six. And, you know, they normally, you know, whinge and moan about it a little bit. And it's like, well, hey, figure it out then. Like, I'm not going to solve this for you. Like, you are talented enough to be able to do this, but you've got to work this out as well. And just give them that level of, make them competitors. Because I think it is one of those areas too where when everything's going super well, they are naturals. But what happens when it gets hard? And that's when you start to see a few more cracks in players as to, okay, well, now does this still exist? The ability is not the problem. Like, the ability is clearly there, but what is their mental side like? Can you set some things just in place for them to have to deal with? Like whether it be leadership skills, whether it be game scenarios, whether it be just a teaching situation, whatever it is. Like, but I think that is one of the areas that you can, you know, use them. Like, but test them. Like, don't be content with, like, you might be teaching Euro steps with an inside hand finish, as an example. It's like, well, okay, you need to do this, but now you need to do it with a double crossover to start off with, or you've got to get around the first defender before that second defender comes across, and you've got to figure that out. And like, well, no one else is doing this. It's like, no, they're not. Like, work it out. Like,
and you've got to find a way to coach to your best player,
yeah,
not the other way around. Like, that's the hard balance, right? Like, you can't go too far ahead because the other players will fall further behind because they won't understand it, but you can't hold the natural player back either.
Yep. No, I like it. All right, on to our next one. Dave, we're heading in your direction on this one. So the player that says they understand everything, but the actions would suggest differently on the court. How do you deal with this where all you're saying is, hey, we need this, we need this, we need this. Okay, yeah, yeah, great idea, great idea. Yeah, I'm on board. Then they walk on the court and they do something completely different to everything you've just gone through and you've tried to unpack. What do you do in that situation?
First of all, I question whether they're actually listening to what we're saying as coaches, because a lot of players do like to nod and say yes and they want to please you, but they're not actually listening to the instructions.
Yep.
Second of all, I actually have to think back and just say to myself, was I clear enough with my instructions? Was there clarity given? Did he misinterpret what we spoke about? And did they go out and think this was what success looks like? If it's neither of those two, and I feel like I've delivered the message correctly, they've understood the message but still haven't been able to execute it, I feel like now it's time to be moving away from on-court and looking at maybe film, because I feel like that's where a lot of our athletes are at. And if they can visually see, hey, this is what we spoke about, this is what you did, now I ask the question of why did that happen? I feel like there's some common ground there where we can get to an answer, and then hopefully the next time around we're able to implement or execute the instruction correctly. So that's usually like the steps I would take with that.
Yep.
It probably happens more often than you think, but for different reasons, as I said. And a lot of the reasons are, like, as coaches we need to check, were our instructions clear enough? Was there clarity given? Were we specific enough?
Yep.
Yeah, look, I agree with, pretty similar to Dave. I would ask questions, but I would make sure they're direct questions where it wasn't a yes or no answer, first of all, like asking them, after this cut, where should you go? Things like that. If they're still not picking it up, I would also follow up with film, but in an example where they didn't follow the instruction, I would pause it just before they're about to go there and go, where should you go next? So questions like that where they can't yes and no me, they have to answer the question, because if they can answer it, then they are retaining it and maybe it's something I'm doing, right? So that's how I would gauge those players, because they're just like, yeah, yep, gotcha. Mm-hmm.
And you got to take into account too, sometimes players just want that interaction over. Like they're not comfortable having that chat with the coach, so consequently they're just going to agree to everything to get out of there as quickly as possible. But the other part is, are they being deliberately defiant? And that's a different challenge altogether. Like if they sit there and they take a shot which should have been a pass to someone else that you've said is a pass to someone else, and they jack up the shot, it's like, well, why did this happen? Like, did you think... like, and there might be a perfectly valid reason for it, which is I was open. I didn't think they were going to be open. And if I didn't shoot it, we may not have got a shot away. It's like, well, okay. If that's what you saw, that's what you saw. But did they make it about themselves in that situation as well? So you do have to unpack a few things for that. I like the idea about make them explain it, because I think that matters. I mean, I really like the idea of look at yourself first, because you might be the problem in that. And there have been plenty of times over the years I have been. It's like, yeah, I did a real poor job of explaining that, or diagramming that off a whiteboard. But finding out why it happened, I think, is the important part, because that can be a really escalating problem, I feel like. And you're going to have pretty quickly 9 other players look at you and it's like, how come they shot that when we all know that they shouldn't have shot that? Or they drove that in there when they weren't supposed to drive that in there. What happened? And they almost look to you for, well, what are you going to do about it as the coach? And they want to see action in that space. So I think the follow-up, when you do it, kind of depends on the relationship you have with the player. I don't think straight after a game is the best time to do it, because emotions are usually fairly heightened by that stage. So I would give it a little bit of airtime, but yeah, I think the follow-up is important. Video does solve a lot of problems.
I think there should be no follow-up during a game. I think it should all be handled before training. I think Zoe said it too. She does it before training as well, so we can take the feedback straight into the practice, I think it was.
Yeah, and there's an end point.
Yeah.
Like, it's not going to go on for 3.5 hours discussing whether that was a good or a bad shot. It's like, hey, we've got to get on court.
Yeah.
Like, it gives you the opportunity that even if that was a situation that hasn't ended super well, like you might have had a disagreement when you're talking to that player about it, at least you have to get back on court and coach them straight away. There's no sort of animosity that can linger after that. It's like, hey, I'm still now trying to get you better on the ball handling stuff coming off the on-ball screen, those types of things. So, Nick, we're on to you for the next one. So the one that you almost forget to coach, like they're there. They don't go through the motions. They perform their role really well. They're not the star player. They're not the weakest player. They're just in the middle, and you kind of forget they're even there at times. And sometimes they are great because you look at the plus minus afterwards and go, geez, they're plus 22. Like, how did I miss that? But other times you're just like, I don't think I spoke to that player at all during this game or training session. And they exist. Mm. But how do you check that, I suppose, more than anything else?
First of all, I try to find out why, as in let's say the plus minus is really high. Like, I'm a big advocate of tracking data. I don't completely lean on it, but I think it's a really important tool to have. And I would find out why the plus minus is high, but they're just playing this role with minimal to no stats on it. I actually did it a while ago. This is probably about 10 years ago, where there was one kid who played in my starting five. He registered no rebounds, no points, but the other four players, their plus minus went up when he was on the floor, and I couldn't figure out why. And it turned out that, and I don't even know if this is entirely accurate, it's the only thing I came to in the end, but he screened better than everyone else. He set away screens and on-ball screens better than everyone else. So finding what their skill is that applies to the team is important for them to know, so they don't feel like they're just a witch's hat on the floor to fill a rotation, or, you know, I'm just here to just give this player a rest. That's not true. At least for me, that's never been true. I never just have a player out there for the sake of having them out there. So just find what their niche is, because it has to be something. You've obviously picked them and you're playing them for a reason. What is the reason? And make sure that they're aware of it as well, so they can double down on that.
So how do you go about keeping that kid engaged? Because there is a tendency at times where it's like, hey, the coaches aren't even talking to me. Like, how do you make sure that you don't miss a player along the way?
Yeah. This is going back a while, like 15 years or so, when I think Greg Popovich was in his prime. He spoke a lot about having two-minute conversations with every player on the roster, whether it was pre-practice or pre-game. And that's something that I've always sort of tried to do since I heard that. And I just feel like it's such a good way to check in with where everyone's at individually, not in an environment where everyone can hear what their concerns are or what's going well for them. just their own personal, hey, this is good. Oh, this is not great. Or I have a question here. We've all coached multiple players that don't like to ask questions in the large group settings. And just being able to give them that 120 seconds, yep, one-on-one, really helps take away some of those things that you're talking about where it's like, hey, I'm not forgetting you. I know during practice you're pretty quiet. You get things done 98% of the time, so I don't need to be on top of you. But I'm just making sure, how are you going? Are you happy? Is there anything you need help with? What can we support you with? So I think those check-ins are always super important. And like Nick said, if the team is constantly doing well when that player is on the floor, I just need to find out why. And it's, yep, not always as easy as checking the stat sheet. It, yep, could simply be like, hey, he's a great screener, or hey, he's a great organizer. Not getting many assists, but the team's always,
yep,
in the shape we need offensively when this player's on the floor. Or, hey, he's a great team defender. Not really getting blocks or steals, but when that player's on the low split line, we don't get scored on at the basket. And just finding why that player is so valuable, because there's a reason why I'm not giving that person continuous feedback. He's usually, he or she's usually doing the right thing. And just making sure that they know we really appreciate it as coaches and as a team. Yeah.
And it is a challenge, because the biggest fear you probably have is that that player's not there anymore. And you always notice it when they're not there.
Yep.
More than anything else. So you do want to validate that as much as possible, I feel like. And I think the use of the player's name really helps in, yep, that as well. It's like, you know, don't just say, you know, hey, good job on the box out. It's like, hey, Dave, great job on the box out. Saw it. Like, and that might be why you have no rebounds to your name, because you've gone and boxed out two kids on the other side, and the kid that just flies in, grabs the rebound, gets the stat on their box score, looks like a genius. And it's like, yeah, but they've only got that because of the other player that's managed to do that. And it is the grunt work. And it's probably my one gripe, I suppose, with the My Hoops app, is that everyone goes on there and checks how many points were scored. And it's like, yeah, but dig a little deeper. Like, there's some other stuff in there as well, whether it be assists, boards, you know, defensive rotations, called safety when the shot went up, like, and organized D-trans. Like, those things matter. And like, for mine, try and bring them into the conversations as much as you can. Make them have a voice. Like, force them to have a voice amongst the group. So if you're not talking to them all the time, make them talk to someone else.
If there are players listening, and you're one of those players, you are so important that we have a name for it. You're the glue guy or glue girl, right? Like, it's so important that we actively look for you. So even though you may find at times that you think it goes unnoticed, it doesn't, because we really try really hard to find you, right, and put you in our teams.
We're usually the one that people give us grief about selecting to.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people won't value what they do necessarily. Like, it's, I don't think in any of my years of coaching basketball I've started the best five players on the team. Like, there's always two or so spots that go to people that complement the other players that do start. And look, I mean, there's been plenty of years where I've coached under 12s and it's different starters every week, but different problem. But usually there are three, I'll say for lack of a better term, star players that you really want to build around, and then you need two complementary players that can just play with them. And then you might get your fourth best player coming in off the bench, but they can carry the scoring of that, but they wouldn't get touches with the first group, so to speak. So it's about balance, I think, with that as well. It's, you don't need, like, if you've got a whole team of glue people, you may struggle a little bit. I mean, your defense will probably hold up, your offense may not. It's probably,
there'll be a lot of passes in that offense.
Yeah, there will. Like, run a lot of actions. Violations will be heavy on that one. The next one we're going to jump into is the social anchor of the group. This is the kid that just brings vibes more than anything else. Not always the most talented, sometimes the weakest player, sometimes the most talented player, but usually just like high energy kids. Like you know when they've entered the gym, because there's a little buzz around what's going on with what they have. They can sometimes be a bit of a distraction, because they are that by the same token. Teammates, you know, enjoy having them around and those sorts of things. But how do you go about coaching the social player, DP?
Love them. You need, yep, them. Don't kill their vibe. That's, yep, really important.
Mm. Love that.
Yep. Because I'm sure we've all coached at least one team where we've had 10 players that are all reasonably quiet, or, yep, maybe not as extroverted. And those teams are difficult to get up for practice. Those teams are difficult to get up for defensive drills or games even, just to talk on defense. Okay. You need that player that has personality, that's not shy, that's going to lead the group in a vocal sense. And it totally changes the way and the confidence that those groups play with. Yep. So, yeah, my number one tip straight away is let them be who they are. Yep. If you ever feel like they're overstepping the boundary, I think it's a small conversation just with that player.
Yep.
Because you need to let him know the same way that we love the player that's setting great screens or rebounding the ball really well, his vocal energy and personality is just as valuable on the court for us.
Yep. And it is a challenge because they are usually the player that also oversteps.
Yeah.
As you said, like yep. whether it be disciplinary, mouse off at the wrong time, those types of things, they are also that player and you don't want to break them.
No.
Like they're really, it's a difficult line to tread,
yep.
I find.
I don't know how this happens, but I find that they do a great job of just naturally building team chemistry.
Oh yeah,
without sure. even having to play basketball, like you know yeah. what I mean. Like they just by being those conversationalists and things like that. In the past, I've given them jobs, and I think I stole this task off you, Dave. But it was, you know, how you go, all right, we get to know each other. You got to find out your teammate's favorite NBA team and what school they went to. Right. And then I would put the social one in charge of that.
Yep.
Right. You've got to manage it. You've got to talk. You've got to make sure people are on top of it and stuff during the drink break. So you just got to give them some boundaries when they can use it. And it just lets them use their natural skill of just being a social butterfly a little bit as well. But yeah, you've just got to make sure it's pointed in the right direction as well.
Yeah. And I think like if you have like leadership groups or captains or whatever it is, it's important to always have that person involved.
Mm.
Like you always want them because they'll have the pulse of the group. Even if it's not tactical or anything like that, they'll know who's up, who's down, those types of things too. But they're also probably the one that will be trusted by the teammates the most because they won't be viewed as a competitor, I want to say. Like they'll be viewed as, oh, they're always fun. Like I enjoy playing with that person because of whatever goes on. You know, they're fun. I suppose the challenge is don't become so reliant on that player only bringing the vibes.
Mm.
For like you still have to bring your level of that. You still have to bring it out in other people because I think as a sport, we probably generally have more conservative people than we have, you know, the extrovert out there type personality. That's probably changing a little bit now with NIL and those sorts of things and everyone needs to have a brand, they're feeling like at the moment. But it's a different space.
Yeah,
it's a bit of a challenge.
It's a different space. Just going back to the player we're talking about, I think we spoke about a glue guy for the last personality type. This would be someone I would call like a connector.
Yep.
Very much just connects the group, keeps them going. And you're right, like it's important no matter what that they help provide the brand for the team.
Yep.
And yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I like the idea of using them as your barometer. Like if they come in flat, there's a reasonable chance your whole group's coming flat. And okay, well, what's going on? Like, why has this happened? Like, is it exams week at school or is it just, you know, the cold winter months and no one's really feeling this at the moment? Like, where are we at? And you can kind of use them as, okay, that's my check on where the team's at the moment. But, God, do you need them?
Oh, sometimes even if, like, if you get them on board,
yep.
as in you sell this is how I want to play and they buy in, you almost walk away from the conversation going, team's ready. Because, you know, that you know it's just going to spread. You know, but it can work on the flip side as well. So that's why they're so important.
Yeah, they are. And it's, yeah, you don't know you don't have one or you don't know how valuable they are until you don't have one.
Mm.
Like I remember there was one night I was sitting on a bench at a stadium and I was watching a game on, say, court two and there was a shared bench between court two and court three. And I was listening to what was going on court three behind me, like the players on the bench. I'm like, who is this kid that will not shut up? Like, and I turn around and I see where the team's from. I'm like, okay, well, I know someone from there. I'm like, who is this kid? And they're like, greatest kid in the world. Like, cannot play to save their life. Like, they are a bad, bad basketballer. But everyone loves them. Like, the whole team rallies around that person. I'm like, yeah, they haven't got on the court yet, but they also haven't shut up for the last 35 minutes. They don't care. They'll wave the towel. You know, they'll be that kid. Is, you know, they're so hard to find.
Mm.
But again, so valuable when you've got them. The externalizer, And this is also be one that I would call as the bad teammate. This is the one that they're never accountable for something that goes wrong. It's always someone else's fault. That's always, you know, they've always got something to say after the fact. Like you deliver a message and then, you know, there's always something, a little bit of a bite back as to what that looks like. You know, you try and challenge them on something, you try and give them feedback and there's a pushback straight away. And it's, they're not overly receptive to that. Like, how do you deal with that type of a player, Nick?
I think, first of all, make it super obvious as to what the decision is and how we can better it. Like, for example, if a player tries to drive and go one on three, I'll say freeze. We'll take the defense back to where they've made that play and then say, who's open? Right, it's an obvious answer, and they usually do push back on the first question. Yeah, but I thought I had a layup. Cool, who's open? Right, and just make it really direct. They're open. Okay, you got to throw to them because you've drawn defenders. You got to find the open player. I think being direct with it. I think also following up again with film. Like there's nothing groundbreaking about this. As these players are open, this is what we spoke about in practice. I understand what you're saying. So you do have to acknowledge what they're saying as well and not push back either. So you have to acknowledge, yep, understand, you can make that layup, but we're not working on whether you can make the layup, we're working on the decision, right? And the decision will help you go higher levels. The layup might help us now, but the decision-making will help us. So trying to sell it to them that way and work with them. But yeah, really important to acknowledge what they're saying without getting defensive as well, because you do, because sometimes the pushback is a little bit abrupt. But you've got to be able to, kind of deflect that and keep the conversation going forward. Yep. Yeah.
Dave, how do you find the balance between emotional whinging, for lack of a better term, which happens in games, like we see that all the time, versus like a continual pattern of behavior? And when do you feel like you need to call it out and just say, hey, enough, like we can't keep going down this path?
Yeah. It needs to be called out when it's disrupting the other nine members of the team.
Yep.
Straight away. That's something that we can't have spread. That'll kill the vibes that we spoke about yep. earlier. So it's important it's stamped out as soon as we feel like it's disrupting the chemistry of that group. The whinging is something I feel like, depending on the level you're at, you can deal with for a little bit. But it needs to have reasoning behind it. If there's no reasoning, and I'll go back.
Yep.
There needs to be some reasoning behind it in terms of if someone feels like they're getting hard done by at practice because I'm calling fouls for somebody and not the other, I understand it.
Yep.
And maybe the player I'm not calling the fouls for is a lot bigger, a lot stronger, so I feel like, hey, from a physical standpoint, they should play through that because on a Friday night, that's what they're going to have to do anyway.
Yep.
And I feel like it's better for them. So if there is some sort of whinging for those double standards, I understand it. It's probably on me to explain to them why I'm officiating the game in that way, shape or form. If the whinging is constant and sometimes doesn't really have any backing as to why it's happening, we need to have a conversation around what that player's expectations are, what the standards are of the team, and basically let them know this is not appropriate moving forward.
Yep.
So a couple of different answers there.
Yeah, would you do that one-on-one or would you do that in front of the group? Like, is there a better way to do it, you found?
Yeah, I think that one's one-on-one.
Yep.
Simply because, as I said, if I'm allowing a little bit back and forth because I feel like it's a really competitive environment and I allow players to express how they're feeling on the court because it is an emotional game at the end of the day.
Yep.
And I never want my players to play with no emotion. So I feel like if I'm allowing it, when it gets to the point where I'm not happy with it, I'll let the team know. But if it's someone I need to speak to one-on-one specifically about it, that's a separate conversation pre or post-practice.
Yep. Because there are times as well that player can be really valuable because they're pointing out something that you may have missed.
Yeah.
Like they're feeling it, they're involved in that up and down. So you've got to be careful as well to not just dismiss everything as, would they just stop? Like I'm over-dealing with this all the time. All we ever do is go backwards and forwards on this. Like you've got to be careful because, again, sometimes they can have a point. Like, and that's the challenge is we've got to try and find, is this a pattern of behavior? Is this a one-off? Does this only ever happen in certain times? you know, when they get a matchup that causes them problems, then I start to see it a little bit more. But I think there are times I would certainly prefer, similar to what you're saying, go down the one-on-one path and, hey, have that chat one-on-one and say, hey, this is not what we need. This is not how we deliver it, those sorts of things. There are times where you may need to do that in front of other players. If other players are like, they're just getting away with this all the time and you hold me to this standard but you don't hold them to that standard, there might be times where you need to say something within earshot of, hey, Nick, we don't need this right now.
Mm.
Like, you know we don't need this right now. Okay, got it. Like, another player hears that and they're like, okay, yeah, I got it. Like, it is being addressed. It's not just being dismissed.
Just be careful how you do that group setting. Sure. Like, it's probably a last resort, because at the same time, if you bring them in and just do it straight away, it's probably going to go worse the other way.
Super poorly.
Yeah.
For sure. And that would be like a passing by comment. That wouldn't be a bring everyone in situation, I think, in that one. But yeah, you do have to be a little careful. Again, are they picking up habits that they're probably getting from elsewhere? Like that, again, that might be the car ride, that might be their friends, that might be social media that are saying, why don't you do this? And they're internalizing that and then externalizing that in a group setting. That might be where the problem comes into it. But yeah, interesting little world on that one. How do you deal with, Nick, the late bloomer? So that might be the kid that you've picked that is maybe not up to it at the time. You've taken a little bit of a chance because you think there's something there that might unlock. They're either underdeveloped physically, underdeveloped from a skill set or an IQ perspective at that point in time, and are struggling to keep up with the game. How do you keep them engaged and coached as you go through this?
Yeah, it's a really difficult one. Probably out of all of them, it's probably one of the most difficult things, because we do have those outside pressures to succeed and compete and win championships and all that sort of stuff. But we have a very important responsibility to develop our players as well. So I would start very small in terms of I would find out where they would succeed the most out of all areas is where I would start. Are they, you know, look, we need them to work a little bit. They're going to be great wings where they can play on the wing, but at the moment they're probably most comfortable in the low post. So I'll just put something in to allow them to get some low post touches while we start to develop other stuff on the floor. So there's still some success points, because if they have a little moment here and there where they succeed, they do improve, right? They're not lagging behind as much either. I think the two-minute conversation that Dave spoke about before is really relevant here as well. Like, having those conversations, you don't have to have them weekly, but you do need to touch base with them every now and again to make sure. Because the reality is, when it's a pressure game, their minutes are probably going to go down early on. Okay, they might go higher as they go along, but the reality is it will be minimal minutes when the pressure is on and you need to win. So therefore, you've got to have probably more regular conversations with them as well.
Yep. Dave, how do you go about sort of protecting them a little bit too? Because there's usually, and I'll give you an example of a team that I once picked. Picked a player, similar deal, like long-term player, thought, yep, we'll give this thing a crack and see how it shakes out. And the parent came up afterwards and said, are you sure? Like, do you really want them in this team? And it's like, well, yeah, I picked them. Like, of course I do. And they're like, but we know they're not up to it right now.
It's never a good start when you hear that from the parents, right?
Yeah, even they were second-guessing me. I'm like, geez, this is the one I should have made happy. Like, not the other way. Like, how do you go about protecting that player from not having the short-term, you know, pressures that they get?
Yeah. I think this is where it's so important that every player is on a different path, and every player has different checkpoints that they need to tick off. It starts with a couple of small conversations with the players, but I think it also needs to build to a larger plan with the parent involved. I think it's so important that the parent's involved in these conversations, because we're probably talking about our VJBL level athletes, right, that are, we can see this boy or girl has a chance to be 6 foot whatever. This is the position they might play in 2 or 3 years, and we feel like the body type that they're currently in and what they're going to grow into is going to be something that's going to be really successful down the line. So it's important that they are not watching friends succeed and make state teams at a really young age, which they're nowhere near close to doing, and they see that as being a failure. It's really important.
It's not a comparison. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not the right way to compare. This is what we need you to do. We need you to improve your shooting form over the next 3 months. We need you to improve your lateral quickness over the next 3 months. We need you to improve your basketball IQ over the next 3 months. So we have these different checkpoints and a different list that we go down. And it's difficult for that player because other players in the team might be moving ahead a little bit quicker than this player would like. But if we have the parent involved and we can get that player to buy into the bigger picture and the long-term plan, I think that's the ideal way of keeping them engaged. If we go back and talk about the VJBL process of it, it's really important that that information is handed over to the following coach for the following year, because there's no point putting a plan in place with a player and a parent, you doing everything you can as that coach to prepare that player for who's in bottom age 16s at the moment, going into top age 16s, and then everything's reversed that following year.
Yep.
You know, it's like, hey, Dave, I thought we were working towards me playing as a wing, and now I've gone back to playing a five as a top age 16 player. Like,
yep,
that would reverse everything that we've sort of put in place for that last 9 to 12 months.
Yeah. What I've got a question. What would you do, because this is a common reaction to these sorts of players as well, how do you navigate the space when you're giving them the feedback? Their knee-jerk reaction is to load up on skills trainers, right, and try and do five or six because, quote-unquote, they need to catch up, right? And sometimes when you're trying to develop these players, they get burnout and then they just stop playing the game. So how do you navigate directing them to, hey, that's not ideal to have a skill trainer every single day on top of your team trainings and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, okay. Like, million-dollar question and all. Look, again...
asking for a friend.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, Orlando's not old enough to need a skills trainer. Look, there is an element of you do need to have that chat, and I think that's similar to what Dave's talking about, that ongoing connection with the parent about, look, this is the path I think we need to go down. And most parents will trust the coach. Like, the hard part is when they start getting external voices as to, hey, what about this? And I can help you do this. And if you sign with me, then I will do this. And it's like, look, they're the ones you've got to be careful. If you show a genuine care and investment, that is more than enough for most parents, I find, to sit there and say, hey, we see that you care. We see that you've given your time in. And more importantly, we've seen some improvement. Like, we see the path you're going down here. And the validation of the work that you're doing may not show up in every session, but it will show up every now and again to just give you that little glimmer of hope of, hey, we're on the right path here. And that's the thing to keep in mind, is that it's not, yes, we're talking the long term, but don't keep the long term goal front of mind. Keep the long term goal as a byproduct of numerous checkpoints along the way that you can now work towards. And will a skills trainer help that? Maybe, who knows? You know, there are plenty of others that want to train, you know, 12-year-old kids like they're NBA and WNBA players, and it's like, not the same. Like, just straight, physically not the same. Mentally definitely not the same. So you do have to be a little bit careful there. I don't really care if you can make six crossovers in front of a cone and then pull up and hit a side step three. I'd love you to just catch it on your inside foot and be able to shoot it.
Yeah.
Like, for mine. Like, that, you know, that's a thing on my end. I don't know if you're any different, yeah, Dave, but that's kind of my take.
I mean, I don't have a perfect plan to it, but like, my first thing straight away is just quality over quantity would be the first thing I would be speaking to that family and that player about. It's not about how much work we can fit into the week. It's about how much quality work can we put into this week. Am I getting two really good rep training sessions, which I think most teams get, and hopefully they're getting coached the right way and good things are happening there. Hopefully they're getting a competitive game on a Friday night. Now it's like, okay, is there somebody I trust where I can get a little bit of additional skills work on top of that just for one session a week, an hour? So now I've got my two rep sessions, which are team sessions. I've got my individual or my team little group skill session that I'm working on some individual skills. I have more than enough now that's happening in a quality setting with a coach that I can take away and pull apart and say, cool, this is what I did with my rep coach and I want to work on that at home for half an hour. And this is what I did with my skills coach. I want to work at home on that for half an hour. That's making up your week. Like, you've got your two rep sessions, you've got your skill session, you've got your game. Those are four sessions right there. And then you're just doing a little bit at home on top of that. Quality over quantity is just so important. rather than the overload of cramming as much as we can in with multiple voices. I think there's a lot of really good coaches in Victoria and Australia, but I think it's always hard for athletes to listen to six or seven different voices.
Yep.
Because the long-term plan, for instance, may not be the same for every single coach. Every coach might have a slightly different goal.
Yep.
And if they're not all working together, it's probably not the best thing for you as an individual athlete.
I wonder. I always wondered those kids that did all those skill sessions, when do they do their homework and stuff?
They don't.
Yeah, like have to, right? Like there's no way you could do all of it.
No, I wouldn't have thought so. And yeah. I don't disagree with anything you've said there. Like I think it's a genuine concern. Like when have you got time to actually go and be a kid?
Yeah.
And just go and enjoy life. But, it, I mean, that happens at the professional level too. The amount of players that go in with a trainer and get asked, well, okay, what do you want to work on as a player? And the player's like, what are you talking about? Like, you tell me. Mm. Like, well, no, you know your game. What areas need work on this and we'll work towards that rather than the trainer that walks in there, then we're doing this because I saw it on YouTube. It's like, well, that's not helpful. Like, that's, you know, how does that make that player any better? You know, that's the problem, I suppose, I see with it. As well there. Our next athlete, the alpha dominant competitive person, the person that needs to win everything, will cut corners to win everything, will just go out of their way to you know, test your boundaries on that as well as to what that will look like. They push back on some things, not because they're being bad people, but just because they want to win all the time. How do you go about dealing with this, Dave? Because I mean, personally, I don't have enough of these in my teams, as it turns out, over the years. But how do you go about coaching them?
Once again, like, love them. Yep. We can't kill their competitive side. Like, it's a great – it's probably something that we would want more of our players to have. They're definitely players that test you as a coach because they'll test the drill setup. They'll test the rules within the drill. They'll test your ability to referee the drill if you need to referee at that time. So it's allowing them to be themselves. It's allowing them to not remove any of that competitive side, but it's also getting them to understand, hey, there's a framework we're trying to build here. There's something we're trying to get out of this drill. I can see you can shortcut this to win it, but that's not what we want.
Yep.
I think getting them to understand and interpret and buy into this is what we want from this drill. Can you help us achieve it so that everybody gets better rather than just you winning?
Yeah. Could you use them as leaders, Nick? Or would you be a little bit cautious of using those types of players?
That was a chair, by the way. Sorry about that.
No. It's okay. Again, I've been gradually sinking in this chair as this has gone on. Like, I started at 6'2" and down to about 5'4".
He's done well to stay still, whereas I'm like
killing me.
Moving around and Sorry, what were you saying?
As always.
Yeah.
Is there any concern about using this type of a player as a leader in your team?
I think there's other characteristics that would have to come into play before I make that judgment. So it does depend. Like, I know that's a very common answer, but it does. The way I would not keep them in line, but make sure that it's also enjoyable for them is make all the drills competitive. And if you need to go through a certain action, then you can go, all right, well, we're going to go through this point up to this point, and then it's live 3-on-3, for example. So let's say it's the old flow, right? We want a back cut, we want a handoff, and then from the handoff, it's live 3-on-3. So we just go through the action, and then they get to play out of it after that, and that's where the competitive side comes into it. Now, if they they shortcut that, then you could put some point parameters on it and take points away and things like that. So there's different ways to work around it. But the competitive player, just thinking about it now, I actually – like I really like them in the group, and I'm the same. Like I wouldn't hold them back because they lift the intensity of training usually as well. Right, the 5-on-5s are usually better when they're up and down because they want to win a game, and it starts to annoy the opposition, and the opposition wants to challenge them, so they can really drive that competitiveness. And I'm just a firm believer that winning's a skill as well, and they help you build that skill in a team as well.
Yep, no, I really like it. I have got all of these out of order, and I'm not actually sure how many we're up to at the moment. But I am conscious we're also running out of time. So I'll go with one I know that I haven't gone with, and I don't know if that's 12 or 10 or somewhere in between. The downhill skier. Like the front runner, that when everything's going well, they are the greatest teammate, the greatest player in the world. But the second things get a little bit hard, they start to crack and crumble. Nick, how are you dealing with this type of a person?
I mean, it comes back to those conversations, but I don't know if I'm in like dealing with it too much, if that makes sense, because they're kind of, they're probably, as they're maturing and getting older, they're starting to, that sort of style or characteristic, let's say it's a characteristic, is kind of developing, if that makes sense. So I wouldn't, I wouldn't say that I would address it or pull them aside or anything like that, only if it got really out of hand and really difficult. Like if it was really obvious on the court, it's probably a sub and a quick conversation. But outside of that, I wouldn't go into too much detail.
Okay.
With that one.
Dave?
Probably because maybe I'm a front runner. Who knows? Maybe I'm a downhill skier, right? Like everything's...
I wasn't going to say it, but you know, usually means you've got to be ahead to be the downhill skier, Nick. But your call.
We nearly made it without a little sledge, I tell you what. And that was a skiing reference as well, by the way.
Yeah. I hope I'm not misinterpreting it, but I think a lot of the time this happens with kids who have a lot of success early and don't know how to handle failure.
Yep.
And I think this is why it's so important to somehow get our kids to go through a range of different levels that they play at, where they have some success, they have some struggles, they have some failures, and they have that early in their careers. Because unfortunately, or fortunately, there are some athletes that, as we know, like they make every team all the way through their career, and then it suddenly gets to under 18s and they miss out on something and we don't see them again in the sport potentially. Doesn't happen too often, but it can be a thing that we've seen previously, and it has happened previously. Getting them to deal with it and understand like it's a part of sport and it's a part of I think maturity is probably the biggest thing. Like when I think of players that I've coached that are like this, most of them are probably around that under 14 age group mark. Yep. So I know it's a little bit difficult because I'm just talking about the younger ones, but so much of it is about getting them to understand process over result, and are we still doing and achieving what we set out to as a team? Are we still doing and achieving what you set out to as an individual? If that's the case, then the scoreboard doesn't matter or your stats don't matter. So it's always just trying to get them to take one step back, look at the bigger picture and see if the process is still ticking along the right way.
This is a really difficult one because there's some adults that haven't figured this out.
Oh, of course there is.
Right? Yeah. Like that's yep. And there's a lot of them out there, like the front runners. So it's a, yeah, it's kind of leaning towards like a life skill more than a,
yeah.
Then something on the basketball court.
Yep, I agree with that. And, I mean, I'm looking at this from a child perspective, like we'll say that under 14 level kid. I love that they care enough.
Yeah,
like,
true.
The fact that they're a bit salty that they're losing, I love that they care enough about it. Like that's the first step for mine into becoming that competitive, like, just beast that they can turn into. I think the challenge is harnessing it for good. And it's like, how can you turn that pout, dummy spit, you know, mentality, behavior into something for good? And I think the more you can probably recreate those scenarios at a training session, it's like, yeah, we're going to put you in a disadvantage here. Like, again, similar to what we were talking about before, make it harder. Like, put them in that situation more often, and eventually they're going to have to self-regulate as to where they can figure out, okay, I can't keep sitting out of everything every time something gets hard. I've got to find a way to jump back into this or contribute in some capacity as well, because ultimately you don't tend to trust this player down the stretch. Like that's the danger, I suppose, of it is that, you know, if they're just going to hang their head when things get hard, it's going to be really hard to get them into a game that matters.
This comes down to external pressures as well, right? Yeah, they sort of all kind of link into that a little bit, like what's being said off the court.
Yep, it does. So hopefully, however many that's ended up being, that has given you a little bit of insight into some of the player behaviours and how you can hopefully try and address them. There's some common themes, obviously, that shone through in all of that. The more communication, the better. Like, understand the player, ask the questions. That's, you know, core 101 of what we do as coaches. The more you can be in that space, I think it's going to help you out a lot as a coach. And nothing is unfixable. Like, everyone can be coached. And so just keep that front of mind before we dismiss them and just got to say, can't coach that kid. You probably can. Just find a way. It's find where the common ground sits and go from there. All right, on to the social split talk for the week.
I'm the post on Facebook. Let's go.
Like me on Twitter.
Gino Auriemma from the UConn Women's Head Coach Program with this week.
You can't change, but at some point, you know, you realize all of us as coaches, I think the way we act, especially today, the way we act has a huge impact on our players. They're so impressionable because they look at you different than they may have looked at you 5 years ago. So now if you're like killing a kid and you're telling them that they stink, they don't want to fight you a lot of times. They want to just crawl in a hole because a guy that they really admire and look up to just told them that they're horrible. I found out that when I'm on the sideline now, the angrier I get, the more animated I get. If I overdo it, it has a negative impact on my team. It took me a while to realize that, and maybe that's just the times that we live in now.
And once again, forgot to take the last bit out.
That was loud, that one.
Yeah, it was. Apologies to everyone who was still listening on that one. Important message, though, and I was just thinking as that was playing, how many of the player behaviours and personalities we were talking about previously are drawn upon straight from the coach? Now, I spoke a lot about the car ride potentially and obviously the parental influence that that can have, but also how much of it is exhibited from the coach? Like, does the coach have the dummy spit and, hey, it's getting hard and I'm out? Is the coach becoming ultra competitive and how they coach flows on to how the players act, those types of things as well? So, yeah, the more I was sort of thinking about it, it's like, geez, coach behaviour really has a lot of impact on what players see and what they regulate and what they use in that space. Like, it's, I mean, Deepa, you're one of the calmer coaches I've seen. Like, how do you go about being calm, I suppose, as a coach on the sidelines?
Yeah, I've been through a range of different coaching personalities across my years.
That's okay.
I don't think I started off as the calm coach, but I've found a way to maybe make that something that I, or the way I coach it lately, is probably more of the personality I take on now. I guess the reasoning for it, first of all, is just I felt like if I was up and about, loud, stressed, my players played a little bit to that way. Yep. They were up and about, they were energetic, but they're on edge a lot of the time. I felt like if I was stressed and panicking, they were stressed and panicking. So it's definitely something I've tried to dial back. The way I go about it is there's a lot of venting to my assistant coaches quite often.
There is.
I've done a much better job. I've done a much better job for a while now of really laying off the referees and not really not verbalising thoughts. Just controlling what I can control, which is, it's easy to say, hard to do, but I think it's something that I've worked on as a skill and, you know, less conversations with the referees, more conversations with my assistants, more conversations with my players on the bench. And that's allowed me to just stay calm. The more I coach or the longer that I've coached for, I've realized that 90% of what I've done has and won't change when I go into the game because our preparation really tells the story of how we play that game. We're probably only controlling 10% or so during the game. So if I've prepared everyone well, if I feel like we've done what we've needed to across the last week or 2 weeks of practice, I feel like I can go in there calm. This is our game plan. This is what we're trying to achieve. And it's my chance to just enjoy us playing the game that we love, because at the end of the day, that's what the players are doing. They're playing the game that they love, so I should just go there and enjoy that game as a coach.
Yeah, well, it's a cracking answer, Nick.
Yeah, it's a very good answer. Yeah.
Can you beat that?
No, so I'll go in the other direction. I do struggle with the emotional regulation and all that sort of stuff as well, so I find that I can't remain calm, so I have to channel it somewhere else, whether it's, you know, go talk to an assistant coach or walk along the baseline and grab some lollies or go pick up a bottle of water and do a lap around the bench. So by the time I get back, I'm checked. But I've got to figure out a way to regulate my emotions. I try to do those tasks. I learned something the other day. I was reading about it. Psychologists were talking about tennis players. So have you seen how sometimes they tap their hand with the racket or they string the racket with their fingers, that's them regulating their emotions. So, you know, they go nuts and go crazy. They use that as a psychological tool to regulate it. So, yeah, I'm like Dave, he is very good at being able to like stay calm, stay in the moment. I don't do it as well. Like, right, my emotions get the best of me. So, like, that's where I've got to direct it and move it somewhere else, so to speak.
Easy. Coaches, that is all of us done for this week.
Go
best
Knicks.
Of luck with your game. Yeah, well, you've
snuck it in there.
Well, there might not be in New York by the time this episode drops. We'll see how that looks. Coaches, thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you all again next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.